This is March 25th, and Gerda and I are in Solvang, California, interviewing.
My name is Carlo Peterson, and I live in Solvang. I'm the Lutheran pastor. I was born in Kolding, Denmark, which is on the east coast of Jutland. I lived there with my grandmother, my mother, and my uncle, and a half-brother. Okay. And my grandmother was Christine, and my mother's name was Maria Christine Peterson. My uncle's name was Christian Peterson, and my half-brother's name was Hans Adolf Warnebeck. As much as I can. I was raised, reared in Kolding, and I lived three different places in Kolding, down by the harbor on a road called Gramrolighedsvej, and then on Grogsvej. I was born out of wedlock, and I don't know my father. My mother died when I was 9 years old, and consequently, I was reared by my grandmother, my uncle, and then we moved to another uncle a year or so after my mother's death, and his name was Mortensen, and he was married to my mother's sister. So grandmother and I moved there. My brother went to sea on a fishing vessel, and to my uncle, who was a pilot in Kolding Harbor, found his own room to live in. Then I went to Kolding Drengeskole to the seventh grade, and then my uncle thought that I should go to a realskole, so I went to Dalsgaards Realskole, and there I had my 3 years of English, German, and French. And then he wanted me to work on the same industry where he was, the same firm, which was a soap factory, where my mother also had worked. I went over there and I worked in the office, in the front office there, but one day the boss called my uncle in and myself in and said, Carlo is no good for this. So I was fired. I wanted to be a painter, but a house painter, but this was not in the cards. And so one day, after I had been working in different places, I worked in N.C. Nielsen's tobacco firm, Angro, and retail. And then I worked at Christian Fries, his wine company in Kolding, washing bottles and bottling wine and delivering. Then I saw an announcement in the paper about the Coast Guard needing some people, and then I went to Copenhagen and tried for that, and I passed all of the tests until we got to the physical, and they discovered that I had flat feet, and therefore they could not use me. Then I stayed with my brother, who had moved to Copenhagen at that time and was married and had a little boy. I stayed with them while I was in Copenhagen. And then I went to the United Steamship Company and tried to get a job on one of their boats. I got a job on the passenger liner that went between Copenhagen and Aarhus. The name was Hans Brohe, and I made several trips with that one. Then I got a job on an English a boat that went to England, Roa, and I made one trip with that, came back, and then I got a job on a South American boat, Oregon, and I made one trip with that, and we came back to Denmark in 1939, and then at that time the war, of course, was beginning to spread. And the Seamen's Union demanded that we had one lifeboat at least with a motor in it. So we had to wait for that. And finally it came, and we took off on the 1st of April, 1940. And then when we had been 9 days at sea, we heard about the invasion of the Germans into Denmark. So instead of going to South America, which was our goal, we went into the Canary Islands. The skipper went ashore. When he came back, he had new orders, and we went to West Africa, to Freetown. And there we stayed on the river for about a month. And then an English Navy crew came aboard, and we were then asked whether we wanted to continue to sail aboard the ship under British flag or whether we want to become political prisoners. All the crew decided to go on, and then we went to Cape Town in South Africa. We were in dry dock, and they placed a 6-inch gun on the after deck and machine guns on the bridge. And then we plowed the sea between South Africa and England with iron ore. We were in convoy, and several times we were shot upon and bombed. At one time, coming into England, a bomb hit the after deck, made a dent in the deck and in the mast, and then went out and exploded in the ocean rather than aboard the ship. Then on another trip, when we came back to Cape Town, I got sick. I had appendicitis, was taken to the hospital, had surgery. When I got out, I got a job on a Norwegian oil tanker. And on that, we went to Australia and India, different places of that nature. Came back to Cape Town. Then on our way to Trinidad, we got torpedoed 60 miles off the coast, got our lifeboats out and came in, stayed 2 weeks in Trinidad on the racetrack, met many other survivors there, and then an American troop transport took us to America, and we landed in New Orleans the 5th of October 1942. I did have an aunt and uncle in Chicago, whom I had seen only once. That's when they were home from America, when I was 5 years old. My grandmother had made a trip to America when she was 72, and only by pictures did I know my aunt and uncle. I had another uncle in Chicago whom I had never seen, and an uncle in Iowa whom I had never seen. And I didn't know how to get hold of these relatives. All I knew was their name, and I was not familiar with how to look up relatives in America. But one night in the bar, in the hotel where we were staying in New Orleans, a lawyer became interested in these two young boys who were there. One was from Australia, and I was the other one. So we got to talking, and I told him about my aunt and uncle in Chicago, and he said that he would help me locate them. So he did the next day. And then I went to Chicago, and my aunt and uncle met me at the railroad station. I stayed with them, and I went to the immigration office in Chicago, and that was my first experience. We came in with my aunt to the office, and when I said my name, the first thing that the immigration officer said to me was, "Oh yes, I remember you. You better turn around and get out of the state as soon as possible." And we looked, and of course I had never been to the States before, and he was completely mistaken. So he went to the file, and he looked up and came back and said, "Yeah, okay, I was wrong. But anyway, you can't stay here regardless." So I registered, and then on the passport or or visa, whatever we got from the Norwegian consulate was good for 30 days, and then we had to ship out again. But I was trying for an extension. That's why we went down to the immigration office. But they wouldn't listen to me down there. So then, when my 30 days were up, I went to New York, and I went to the Danish consulate down there, and I gave him my story, and I suppose I embroidered it a little bit, that I had nightmares and all that kind of stuff. I hadn't been off the ship for 3 years, had been bombed and machine-gunned and torpedoed and all that sort of stuff, and I was dreaming about it at night. So he said, well, we'll see if we can get a 60-day extension for you. So he sent me to Ellis Island. And I went to Ellis Island, and fortunately for me, I met a nice old gray-haired gentleman over there. And he understood, I suppose, this young man. So he said, okay, you go back to Chicago, and in a short time you'll be notified that you have your 60 days. So I went back to Chicago and reported again to the immigration office. But they were not so kindly disposed, so they put all kinds of things on me. Well, then the 60 days were gone, and I went back again to New York, and luckily I found the same man at the Ellis Island, and he said, you do like to stay? And I said, yes. So he sent me back again. Until you hear from us, you can stay. So I went back again. Now, that didn't make it any easier downtown at the immigration office in Chicago. So they started to... Then they said to me, have you registered for the draft? And I said, no, I didn't know I had to register for the draft, and you didn't tell me. Well, if you are here more than 30 days, they said, you have to register for the draft. So I said, good. Because that's exactly what I want to do. I had the idea that getting into the service, somehow I could come back to Denmark as an American soldier and get over to Europe, and then that way into Denmark again. So I registered, and every day I went down to Draft Board 29 to hear if I could get in. I pestered them every day. In the meantime, the immigration people were looking out for me, too. They had FBI out there interviewing me, and I played a little game with them about my nightmares and all that sort of stuff. And so they sent me out to the Marine Hospital for an examination by the doctor out there, which I passed with flying colors. And he looked at me and he said, hey, man, you just want to get in the service, don't you? And I said, yeah, that's right. And so finally I was drafted and was classified 1A, and finally I was drafted and I joined the Navy Seabees. I was in the Navy Seabees for 3.5 years, and one day on the firing range, a officer came up to me by the name of Ravenholt, and he said, are you Danish? And I said, yes. He said, are you a citizen? I said, no. Would you like to be a citizen? I said, yes. So he says, okay, you meet me after you're through here in the firing range at the personnel office. So I went over there, and he started proceedings for the citizenship papers to come through. And I got my citizen papers in Hawaii in 1945. I was discharged in 1946, and then I started my studies at Grandview College in Des Moines, Iowa, junior college of the American Evangelical Lutheran Church. And after 2 years, I also went to Drake University and got my degree in sociology, a BA. I met my wife at the college, Marion Mortensen. She was from South Dakota, Gayville, South Dakota. And she came in the same year to Grandview as a teacher in the commercial department. Later, they gave up the department and she became secretary to the president while I finished my studies for the ministry there. Our first call to the ministry was in Newark, New Jersey. And then after 3.5 years, we had a call from Ringsted, Iowa. We went there, and we were there for 5.5 years, and we received the call from this church here in Solvang, Bethania Lutheran, and we came here in 61. And we had on the question of getting into to the ministry, like I told you previously, I didn't have any bright lights or anything of that nature happening to me, and I can't give you the date and the hour and the year, but I can point out some milestones, I think, which as I look back on which I can hang this call to the ministry. One was as a child. When we played house, which we did in my childhood with one another, I was always the minister. I never got to be the husband, but always the minister who did the baptizing of the dolls that Grete and Hans they had as their children. And I always did the burying, too. So in childhood, I was cast in that role as a minister all the time when we played the house in our neighborhood. Then when I got into the Merchant Marine, I had the experience of meeting people, not in the nightclubs or in these houses of prostitution, but in Cape Town, for instance, I met the watchman who was aboard the ship at night. And he invited me and one of the other boys to visit his family, and so we did. And he had a cousin who was a female, about my own age, and then she invited me to her home. And I spent much time with them, and they were of a religious persuasion, which I today would call a cult, and might also be termed holy rollers by some people. But when I was out there, her folks and their friends would always meet in the kitchen and shout and praise hallelujah and read the Bible and sing some of these real peppy shouting gospel songs. Then one night when I left the house, her father said to me, "Carlo, are you a Christian?" And I said, "Yes, I'm a Christian. I'm baptized in the Danish Lutheran Church. I'm confirmed in the Danish Lutheran Church. I'm a Christian, of course." So he said to me, he said, "Do you have a Bible?" And I said, "No, I don't have a Bible." "Well," he said, how can you be a Christian and not having a Bible, not reading the Bible?" "Well, I'm baptized, I'm confirmed in a Danish Lutheran church, and that's it." So he didn't say any more, and I didn't say any more. But he had caused me to think. So the first thing I did when I came back aboard the ship that night was to go looking for a Bible. I didn't find any that night, but the next day the chief mate had a New Testament in the ship library. So I took the New Testament and I started reading the New Testament, but it didn't make any sense to me, and the reading didn't last very long. Then I came to Australia, and I met a girl there, and she invited me home. And first I met her on the street. I was in the bakery. We were buying baking goods for the afternoon coffee, which we always did on Sundays when we were in port. Otherwise, we baked ourselves. And here I saw this girl coming out of this gate across the street from the bakery with her bicycle. And I whistled, and she went down the road with her little dog. And then the cook and I walked down with our pastries back to the ship. And when we came down to the corner, I saw her dog go that way, and she went that way. And she went down the road a little bit. That's the same way we were going. And then she turned around and came back, and I stopped her, and I said in my broken English, I said, "Your dog went that away." That was the opening conversation then. So I asked her if I could take her to the movie, and she said, "Yeah, but you have to come over and talk with my mother and ask her permission." So I said, "Okay, I'll come over tonight." So I came over there tonight, and mother invited me in, and I asked if I could take her to the movies, and her mother said, "Yeah, that'll be fine." And so that was all there was to it that night. So I came over the night we were going to the movies. I was invited in, and then her mother said, "Okay, Carlo, the bus leaves up on the corner at such and such a time. It gets to the movie house at such and such a time. It'll take you 2 minutes to walk from the bus stop to the movie house. The movie is out at such and such a time. It'll take you 2 minutes to walk from the movie house to the bus stop. It leaves there at this time, and it'll stop down here at that time, and it'll take you 5 minutes to walk from there to the home, and I'll have a cup of hot tea for you when you get here." That's the way I got acquainted with Gwendolyn. And Gwendolyn was a Presbyterian, and they had a youth group, and I was invited to go to the youth group with her. And that was another milestone along the way in the call to the ministry. And then when I came to the United States, I went to the Danish Lutheran Church in Chicago, St. Stephen, and the pastor there, Marius Crowe, was influential in continuing my thinking about the ministry and in relating with the young people of that church. In the service at USO Centers, for some reason or another, I always picked up with a girl who was church-related and got invited out to them for dinner, but always to church first. So that was another milestone, an indication that I see now as an indication for me to enter the ministry. The chaplain in my outfit was also influential in continuing this kind of direction. And actually, this is really how I ended up in the ministry.
May we have your family's reaction to your taking on the responsibilities of a church congregation?
Okay. My commitment to our decision to enter the ministry was made prior to my marriage. And I came to Grandview College already committed to the ministry in the Lutheran Church, and it was there I met my wife, and she knew, of course, that I was going into the ministry, and together with my GI Bill, she supported me during those years that I went to college and to seminary. Our first child was born in 1952 in February. And our first congregation was in Newark, New Jersey. I had several calls at the time of my ordination, but I had gone to Newark, New Jersey to visit that congregation. That was the only congregation I visited. And Marion would rather have gone to one of the other congregations from which we had a call to serve. When I went to Newark, she said to me, as I left, she said, "Carl," she said, "I know we're going to Newark, New Jersey, because that's where you're going to visit, and you won't be able to say no, because they are paying your way, and you would feel obligated to go there." And of course, I denied that, but she was right. After I had been there, I felt obligated to go there. So we went there for 3.5 years. It was small congregation, a city congregation. We lived above the church in an apartment. Marion was not too happy with the situation. She is from the country and is a farm girl. We stayed there 3.5 years, and then we came to Ringsted, Iowa, which was a rural congregation. The town is only 600, and we were 1 mile out of town, so we served the countryside more or less. And we stayed there for 5.5, and then we came here to Solvang. Okay, in terms of the life of the ministry, this is a very public affair. I mean, the public eye is always on us, and the kids feel this when they go to school, that they are PKs, preachers' kids. And the public does put certain restraints on them, a certain behavior. You are PK, so you have to behave in this way. And my kids are not that way. They are human beings, and they do things as other kids do them. But they are nevertheless feel that they cannot always do some of these things that other kids do. So it is a strain on them in some respects. And, of course, as far as my wife is concerned, I'm gone quite a bit. I do a lot of counseling, and I'm on call 24 hours a day. And then the fact that I am a workaholic enters the picture, of course. A workaholic. A workaholic. I like my work. I enjoy my work. It is not only work, it is also a form of joy, a pleasure for me in my ministry. And this, of course, sometimes interferes with my life here at home. And oftentimes, you know, we have our little spats about it, that I don't take enough time off, I don't do enough in the yard, I let my work come before. If somebody calls when I'm out in the doing some yard work, I'll drop the shovel or the rig and rake, and I'll go to the office, and I will meet with them, or I'll go to their home and meet with them in the middle of that stuff. So it's not easy to be a minister's wife, or is that too general? Perhaps I should say, it's not easy for my wife to be married to me in the kind of job that I have. That might be more fair, because not all ministers are like I am. It's an individual thing with each man and with each woman in the ministry. So it isn't it isn't the easy thing. But that's, you know, they have their reactions, both the kids and my wife, to this kind of thing. But it's more an individual and a personal matter, and it cannot be classified in general terms of the ministry itself. So it's a personal thing here. My first time, when I went back to Denmark, 18 years had gone by. And of course, in those 18 years, I thought of my family as they were the day I left. I had not seen them change in any way. So when I went back to Denmark in 1958 for the first time after 18 years' absence, the picture that I had in my mind was the picture that I had when I left them, the way I saw them. My uncle was a tall, strapping fellow. My brother was tall and strong. And my nephew was little and tiny. And so was my sister-in-law. And then when I came home in 1958, here I saw my uncle, this big, strapping fellow. He wasn't that big at all. In fact, I was almost as tall as he was, and as big as he was. And the same with my brother. And my nephew had grown up and was married and had a child of his own. This picture, plus the picture of the street where I had lived and my town, had changed tremendously. And this...
You are the pastor in a very Danish church in probably the most Danish town in the country, or perhaps even the world. Would you please reflect upon your role, the role of your family, and the role of the church in that very Danish community?
Well, the role as pastor here is probably not too much different from the role of other pastors in other communities which are not as Danish or not Danish at all. I think the role as pastor is probably the same. Okay, we do have some differences here in the fact that I do have and preach in the Danish language once a month. We do have an evening which we called a Danish Song Fest, where we gather about 30 to 40 people, mostly, of course, the older generation, on the fourth Friday of the month, and we get out our Danish song book, and we sing the songs that these people sang in their youth concerning the life in Denmark, concerning life in the United States as immigrants. And then we usually have a lecture or a story read at that night, and then we have our coffee fellowship. We also have a Danish ladies' aid within the congregation where the language is Danish all the way through. And we have the Danish Brotherhood in our community. I'm shifting now from the church to the community. The Danish Brotherhood celebrate the 5th of June every year with a picnic in the park, which of course is the Grundlovsdag, the Danish constitution. And we also have a new organization in our community, which is called the Rebel Society, which fosters the relationship between Denmark and America, which was started years ago, back in the 1920s, with Americans celebrating July 4th in Denmark at a park in Denmark which is called Rebil. So these things are happening in our community. And I am, of course, ministering to a Danish community as well as an American community. And I find quite often that the Danish language with some of these older people when they are ill, when they are dying, that they revert to their Danish language, the language of their childhood. And I am fortunate in that I am able to communicate with them in that language. And it's very helpful both psychologically as well as spiritually for these people. So that need is still here in our community. It has to be said, however, that the Danish is gradually disappearing. We still have some customs that we hold on to. For instance, we celebrate Fastelavn every year. In our congregation, we have the barrels. We fill them with candy and a cat, a stalking cat, and then we slå katten a tun, that is, knocking the cat out of the barrel, which is an old pagan custom that we have civilized and baptized so that we can have some fun with that. The old meaning, of course, is not there. It's simply a fun night that we have in our parish hall. Folk dancing is prominent here, and we have a group of folk dancers who put on exhibitions here and there in the community and also in other communities as well. Danish Days is a business venture by the business people in our community. The third weekend in September, they have what they call Danish Days, different activities, folk dancing, and Mr. Tano and his young gymnasts put on exhibition. We have the village band, which ride the Carlsberg of a wagon and playing their trumpet horn music. We have a parade, and these are some of the activities that still reflect Danish customs and Danish traditions. You asked about the commercialism of our Danishness, or that which is Danish, and I think we have to be honest and say that even here, it isn't all because of the love of that which is Danish and an appreciation of it or a respect for it, but here as everywhere else, not alone in our country, but also in other country, there is still the old dance around the golden calf. That I don't think we can escape any place in the world. There are people who do that dance, and they do it here as well as everywhere else. But to put any kind of derogative, demeaning philosophy on this, I don't think is quite right. Everywhere else in the world, the dance goes on. The dance is going on here as well, and I think we just have to be honest and say that. But that doesn't mean that all the people are doing that dance. There are people who are involved in businesses who are doing it because they value the Danish traditions. They value the Danish handcraft in the various areas of craft work, and so they are people who do not to that extent and are capitalizing on that aspect of our life. But it is no secret that tourism is part of the economy of the valley, and it has settled in the town of Solvang. But I live with it, and I think all of us live with it, and this is what we have to do, and I don't think there's anything dishonest about that. People do receive some insight into that which is of another culture, and we try to overcome that aspect, at least in our own life, and hopefully in other lives that touches our lives in this respect, so that they are not left with the impression of just the dance around the golden calf. So I think that's where we are at this time in our history.